Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, maintaining an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business, in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Reston, Virginia, and Greater Boston. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin along with John Krofcik. And John, we do deal in trends, but we try to give you the historical precedent for understanding what is happening today and where did it start and what might that mean going forward. And that's why I found it fascinating talking to David Paul Kuhn about the book The Hard Hat Riot. And do you remember The Hard Hat Riot
at
all?
No, I remember a lot of stuff from the 70s, you know, the Carter years where we had gas lines and
stagnation.
And of course we had our all those people held by Iran. But I don't remember the Hardhead riots.
Well, of course we all remember what happened 4 days earlier, and that was Kent State.
Right, Kent State, yeah.
And we remember those students getting gunned down. And if we go back though to May 8, 1970, we will be getting an amazing account of when it happened, the moment in time when the Democratic Party, which had really almost a stranglehold on the working man and woman in America, blue-collar workers, hard hats, and when that turned. And
that's
it turned.
That's kind of funny. When I was growing up, I remember my grandparents saying, the Democrats are for the working guy and the Republicans, they're for the business guys.
Well, you know, that all started really with FDR. I mean, FDR made some remarkable changes to our politics that really still linger to this day. Social Security, of course, started at that time. The idea that government could be an activist to help people in a time of great panic. And, of course, Herbert Hoover was the Republican who sat on the sidelines and did nothing. And FDR, now many would argue that it was the war that really pulled us out of the depths of the Great Depression. But nevertheless, the hard hats and the working class in America seem to be loyal to the Democrats. But if you go back to May 8th, 1970, and you find that in the canyons of Wall Street, there is a great conflagration between these yippie yuppies who were still protesting what went on at Kent State.
Right.
And they met up with these hard hats who were building the downtown of Manhattan. And they said, we've had it with you ripping up our flag and burning the flag and this, that, and the other. And Richard Nixon was able to take advantage of that and build this silent majority that has gone on for many years, where states that used to be hard Democrat have become really Republican. And many people say, well, these are cultural issues because many of the same people aren't voting their own economic interests for the working man because they're joining the party of the corporate elite. But they were so ticked off by the way America in their mind was being disparaged during the height of the Vietnam War that they turned. And that has been a trend for a very long time in America.
Wow. I didn't realize that. This is all news to me. I think, though, politically, I think both parties have lost its way as far as the working guy. I think they talk a good game. Everybody talks a good game, but when they get in office, nothing, you know, it seems like they're working for somebody else.
Yeah, well, don't forget that it was really this idea of Republican populism under Donald Trump that got him many of those swing states in 2016, because he was able to convince them, you've been forgotten, you've been left out, and I found you, and I remember you, and I am going to help to make certain that your economic interests are going to be served and your job is not going to be offshored. Now, part of this election cycle will determine whether he lived up to that promise. Are there new plants in Michigan and Wisconsin? That's going to be a telling point as to where it is that we are headed in this election. But David Paul Kuhn does such a wonderful job of really helping us to understand where the change from Democrat to Republican began. And it all began with the hard hat riot going back to 1970. You're going to find this
sounds
particular
interesting.
It really is. Today on America Trends.
With me on the line on America Trends is David Paul Kuhn. And he's written this remarkable book that's gotten incredible reviews. People saying that for us to understand the Trump era, we really have to go back to a date certain, May 8th, 1970. And by the way, the subtitle to the book is Nixon, New York City, and the Dawn of the White Working Class Revolution. Now, David, can I be forgiven, as somebody who thinks he knows his history, why I can think back to the Detroit riot, I can think back to Stonewall, I can think back to Attica or Kent State, which predated this event by just 4 days, without sounding too foolish when I say I don't really recall necessarily the hard hat riot.
It largely has been reduced to anecdotes as an example of backlash at most, even among historians. It's, you know, at most garnered a few pages and great tomes of history of the 60s and early 70s. And yet it resonates with the political impact of presidents by the name of Nixon, Reagan, W, and Trump. It is a microcosm of effectively capturing this period in American history, the 60s and early 70s, when the FDR coalition broke apart. And there's no day and no period of several weeks that better captures at its most dramatic and violent level and is true to what would later come than this period of May 1970 and the hard hat riot itself.
It's very interesting because when you do fast forward to 2016, you suggest that the party of the working man now relies on the educated whites and African Americans, and the party of big business depends on working class whites. And we can take this signal event on May 8th, 1970, as one of those moments in time where you can really capture when that began to happen. And Nixon, of course, was smart enough as a politician to take advantage of an opportunity that presented itself. So take us back to downtown Manhattan and what was going on that day. By the way, I remember that day, I've got to tell you, because I'm a big Knicks fan. So that's probably the reason I remember that day.
That's right. And there is a chapter, of course, and you were alluding to is that night, the New York Knicks won their first championship, and it was an epic Lakers-Knicks series. And then, of course, what you also remember, and a lot of people remember, is the next morning in the pre-dawn light. It's the morning when Nixon had this surreal interaction with anti-war activists at the Lincoln Memorial on the day of the massive protest over Kent State. What is forgotten in all that, and that week of Kent State, was the hard hat riot. And what happened was, in some ways, an accident of history. Throughout America, there was this town and gown gap, just as there is today in many college towns, between educated whites and those surrounding sort of these college towns that dot America. In New York City, we forget, and I try to remind readers right away, most ironically, Gotham was, in many respects, an epicenter of middle America. Still by 1970. It was still a blue-collar city. It would suffer the deindustrialization of America before America would suffer it. The Northeast would lose factories that would eventually go to the South and that would eventually leave the United States. But it was still a blue-collar city at the dawn of 1970. And what was also happening was in Lower Manhattan, was what was called a skyscraper renaissance, the greatest building of skyscrapers since the 30s. And of course, most famously, the World Trade Center was being built. Mm. So in downtown Manhattan, you had, by an accident of history, in this narrow space of downtown Manhattan near Wall Street, a kilometer at the time, because there's no Battery Park City yet, you have the World Trade Center being built along with many other towers. because this is it was before this time, this sheer face of Manhattan that tourists now see when they visit was not really yet built in the southern side of the city. So all these blue collar guys were down in lower Manhattan. At the same time, at the height, it is 1970, is the height of the anti-war movement. And after Nixon in late April announces, around April 20th, he announces that he will withdraw 150,000 troops. And there is a sense of great optimism even within the anti-war movement. The media starts writing of basically that the spirit is gone from the anti-war movement because there's far less to resist effectively. A matter of days later, he announces the incursion into Cambodia. And as you know, and as our listeners will recall, all hell broke loose. ROTC buildings were firebombed. There were flags burned. Campuses across America, though not the majority of campuses, the campuses across America were in utter tumult. At the same time, then, of course, that leads to Kent State on Monday. Monday, when Kent State happens and four students are shot dead and others injured by National Guardsmen, the anti-war movement radicalizes as never before. In New York City, home of dozens and dozens of colleges, students would also, and radicals, would also protest on Wall Street at this time, mainly because of the sense that they were the masters of finance and the masters of war. And the United States and Wall Street was the global, unrivaled epicenter of the, you know, of the U.S., of the world economy at the time. So it was very popular to go down to Wall Street, byways of Wall Street, and protest, often in front of Federal Hall, where George Washington was inaugurated. And there, above them, building the World Trade Center and other towers, were all these blue-collar guys. The majority of them had served in Korea, World War II, or some of them had served in Vietnam, and they were statistically, irrefutably, far more likely than the students protesting to have kin and kind in Vietnam at the time. And so by this happenstance of history, these two tribes, if you will, of American life, it's these two Americas that were severing apart. And at this point, after years of upheaval in American life, hardly under, could be, almost not fathom each other anymore at this point, were stuck in this very small area of lower Manhattan. And when Kent State happened and the radicalization was taken to a new level, there were small confrontations, and Monday is Kent State. Tuesday, Wednesday, there's a march of anti-war march downtown on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And basically what happens is there's small confrontations over the flag and the use of the flag to convey opposition to the Vietnam War. And it summates on Friday, where hundreds of construction workers at noon, many of whom came from the World Trade Center and other towers between Bowery and Battery Park City, what would become Battery Park City, I should say, between Bowery and the southern tip of Manhattan, broke into an anti-war demonstration, and violence, really unseen in lower Manhattan, followed. They first broke up the riot. They fought to put up their flag. They seized City Hall and beat college students and activists to the point that they were unconscious on the dirty streets of New York City. And the New York police, in many cases, let it happen because the police had great sympathies and were as frustrated, like many of their blue-collar fellow, with the anti-war movement, and had been battling the students all week since Kent State. And it was not a great day in the history of the NYPD either, but it was a day that captured what was an unrecognized fissure across the Democratic Party, and that fissure was by class. And,
right, and now Vietnam we are going to be able to paint a picture, yeah, I think, that convincingly demonstrates that this moment in time has led to a total realignment in our politics. Let's just go back to that day. And what role John Lindsay, the mayor of New York, played in this? Because he had other ambitions and aspirations, and he wanted flags lowered in response to what was going on in the country. And he really was leading a certain cultural movement. And so I want to talk about whether he was a significant player in all of this.
Absolutely. I focused on New York City because it seems odd today to view, for listeners and viewers of media and you know, our most informed readers to think of New York City as a microcosm of anything American, because it's fairly unlike most of America in many respects. But at this time, that's not true. And one thing that's fascinating about John Lindsay is he was the McGovern Coalition before there was George McGovern. At least I say that before George McGovern was a national figure. And he tested what would become known as sort of a high-low coalition and would win with that coalition just barely in his 1969 mayoral race the year before the hard hat riots. And so Lindsay, that coalition was appealing to, at that time, because of the lack of diversity in America, and America was still very white, this could only work in New York City, but he was hoping to appeal to Puerto Ricans, blacks, and then educated, affluent whites, what I call the white opera crowd. So what would happen is in his effort to build a coalition like that, he became a lightning rod, perhaps not surprisingly, for these blue collar whites who were living at that point across the outer boroughs of New York City. And Lindsay increasingly, irrefutably, was estranged from that constituency. He only started to pay attention to them by the late 60s. And his positions on the Vietnam War, most especially, but on other issues, as he rose to national prominence, made him a symbol of the estrangement between liberalism and blue-collar Democrats of old. And I say liberalism.
Let me go back a year before this, because you point out in the book that Richard Nixon was starting to envision this rupture, and he gave a speech to the Air Force Academy in 1969, anti-elitism, nationalistic, really beginning to form the notion of this new majority, the silent majority, being born. And of course, this was the first major speech that Pat Buchanan wrote for him. And Pat Buchanan, when you think about it, as a thought leader who figured out where this was all moving, he seemed to really be in the vanguard.
He was in the vanguard, and he would get a kick out of that, considering he's such a conservative. He was in the vanguard. And really, I think we have to go back, as I do with the book, to 1968, a little bit before that, right? Because what 68 does is it shocks the establishment. First, there's Chicago 68, the Democratic Convention.
Yeah, talk about rioting of a certain sort, yes.
Exactly. And I return to that, which is much more familiar to history, because it's important in its impact on this growing chasm between quote-unquote elites and traditional blue-collar America. And that's because the media misread Chicago 68. You know, that they were attacked by Chicago police. They saw the students being beat up by Chicago police, and they thought it was their children that got beat up. But Americans looked at the cops and saw their sons, their brothers. They identified with the blue-collar cops. And after the media realized in a week or two that they misread Chicago 68, that triggered some retrospection on whether the media that was, as Joseph Kraft discussed, the famous columnist at the time, was upscale and removed from the great masses, was, you know, it led to some retrospection. Then Nixon won his victory. It's easy to forget how shocking that was to the establishment, that Richard Nixon was supposedly politically dead years before, and he mounted one of the objectively greatest comebacks in presidential history. And between those two shocks and otherwise, looking back at how did the America's intelligentsia perhaps not understand Americans? And that break, I think, set in motion certain astute political strategists, including Pat Buchanan, who pushed Nixon, perhaps more than any other at the time, to recognize that there was a silent middle at the time, silent, that was increasingly estranged from the Democratic Party elites where the energy was in the liberal movement, but wasn't necessarily with Barry Goldwater's wing of the party. And what occurs with, whether it's Buchanan and others, is that Nixon gave the intellectual framework for what was really Nixon's gut. Nixon, since his earliest days as a candidate, had a base feel for lower middle class America. And that was, of course, where he came from. And that strategy was really, oddly, an extremely natural fit for Richard Milhouse Nixon, a man who was awkward in almost all every other respect.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers over 40 years of experience in a broad base of services from accounting and tax to cybersecurity, technology, and transaction advisory. Bloom's experts will maintain an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
David Paul Kuhn is with us. The book is called The Hard Hat Riot, and James Carville says perhaps the best book ever on how Democrats lost the white working class. At the same time, Richard Nixon was a very complicated political figure. Number one, he was starting to sneak into the Democratic tent, plucking big labor, toward his party. But he, at the same time, you point out in the book, and I think a lot of us remember, that he really had some very liberal policies. But at the end of his term, because of all the discontent about government overall and Watergate, that we really hadn't then for a long period of time, we wouldn't see liberalism really come back until perhaps Barack Obama. And even then, it was a rather tepid liberalism that came back. The stimulus that he had coming out of the 2009 debacle financially wasn't really that dramatic. And of course, he took on what was at one point a healthcare reform package that the Republicans had heralded as being the future. So, I mean, really, tell us about that. Help us understand this.
Well, of course, you are correct. Richard Nixon, with a big lift from the Democratic Congress, Nixon was the first president since 1849 to take office with both houses of Congress controlled by the opposition. So that's a key fact that molded Nixon. The other key fact is it's still the dusk of the FDR-LBJ era. So he's playing within a democratic framework of active state liberalism, government as a force to assist the common good. Nixon came in that framework, and his accomplishments are almost unrecognizable to the modern Republican Party. Throughout his presidency, one of the most stunning points, including with Nixon himself, is that he is always operating from the standpoint of government as a force for good. The beginnings of the Goldwater outlook, later made famous with Reagan, right, that to get government out of your way.
Mm-hmm.
We're not at all there. We're minimally present in Richard Nixon's presidency. And he would spend, of course, the Clean Air Act, OSHA, the EPA, Consumer Affairs Office, Voting Rights Act extension.
Price controls.
He was inconceivably liberal. And yet, by modern Republicans, at the same time, he was the Bettendorf of what was increasingly what we call the New Left, right? Which was a more highly educated white, more fluent than the average American. And the New Left saw Nixon as a Bettendorf, and that fissure was most vehemently by 1970. And the late 60s, along, of course, the Vietnam War. And as Watergate occurs and Nixon fell, the hate for Richard Nixon was so strong that the left at the time never fully grasped how much they were invested in his approach of government. And that if you look back at the data and the polling of when Americans stopped trusting government's ability to basically stop seeing government as a force for good, big government as we call it now, it is Watergate. It is not Vietnam. It is not the Pentagon Papers. It is not the mid-60s tumult. It is Watergate when you see the most dramatic shift in views of government. And so when Nixon went down, so did a certain view, a liberal outlook on government. And I know near the end of the book, just as an example of how strong this anger was, that when Richard Nixon's memoir came out, the New York Times and the Washington Post refused, this is years after Watergate, to publish advertisements for a president's memoir. These pillars of free speech refused to publish advertisements for his memoir. I note that because, it carries echoes of today and how Nixon and Trump are extremely different men.
But let me go back to this also. I mean, I understand about his politics at the time.
Yeah.
And a lot of that has been shrouded in Watergate and such. And then, of course, the aftermath of Watergate and the distrust of government. At the same time, politically, he was forging this new long Southern strategy that Angie Maxwell talks about in her book, that he nationalized it in so many ways, using code words and making certain that if you felt a certain way as someone who felt aggrieved and as part of a working class that was being ignored culturally within the American society or being diminished by some of these elites that we talk about, that he was building this new electoral majority based on this grievance.
That's right. I think that I will quote Time magazine in 1970 when they suddenly discovered their own readers, and that being, of course, Middle America, that Nixon was pursuing not so much a Southern strategy as a Middle American strategy. That is not to say, especially as I point out later when busing comes to the fore, that he did not jump onto that racialized third rail when it suited him. I think we have, I would say this, conventional wisdom has overstated the effect of the Southern strategy in shaping the modern Republican Party and certainly what led to Richard Nixon's landslide victory in 1972. It is without a doubt true that the Wallace voters moved entirely to Nixon, I mean, nearly entirely to Nixon by 72. And so within Nixon's coalition are all the issues you're speaking of, and all those issues true in the Deep South. But as I point out in the book, without getting too deep into the Southern strategy debate, if you look at the Southern shift of American politics, when did the Republicans make their first headway in the South? It wasn't in 1948 when the Democrats finally took on the civil rights mantle. It was 1928, along cultural lines, when when a Catholic ran against Herbert Hoover, Al Smith, and there was division over a great cultural divide in America, and whether it was over alcohol and its legalization, or Al Smith being framed as a Catholic pole tied to the big city machine, and all the stereotypes of big cities at the time. And so the first inroads in the peripheral South were along these cultural lines, right? At that time, Catholic, Protestant. And the racial politics and the racial inroads in the Deep South, you know, occur obviously in the era of Strom Thurmond and into Barry Goldwater and George Wallace. And those inroads, which certainly were part and important to the Nixon coalition and what later became the Reagan coalition, were not the deciding factors in, for example, his victory in 1972, when you look at the actual
data. Well, that victory, of course, was the greatest since FDR. I mean, that was a remarkable moment in time. But let's take it forward, because with our podcast, we focus on trends. So sure. This being the most important event, perhaps, leading to the fissure between the working class whites in America and what traditionally had been their home politically. Though you remind us, I think, very interestingly in the book, that although we have a two-party system, that people are fixed. They're not fixed into that system. They are kind of placed there. They would perhaps like more choices, but these are the choices we have. So why was it that at that moment and since that time, this group has more comfortably, culturally, fit into the Republican Party, which used to be the party of business elites and big business and big corporations? How were they able to co-opt that? Because Democrats would often argue you're voting against your own economic interests.
Very few people vote their pure economic interest unless the economic interest is at the fore of the American mind. And what I mean by that is that, you know, the economy matters when it matters. And so that question is always very interesting, because it's been around for a lot of years in modern American politics. It is.
Well, James Carville, who credited you with writing the most important book on how Democrats lost the white working class, said in 1992, as he was helping to elect Bill Clinton, it's the economy, stupid.
Absolutely. And there was a a terrible recession that George H.W. Bush was never able to politically extricate himself from. And it is, if you had to pick one factor that influenced presidential elections, it is the economy. And second to that are incidents of turmoil, such as a war, or perhaps a pandemic. But I would say that that the framing of that question is always what's so interesting, because the framing of that question is always asked, why do lower middle class or working class people not vote, you know, purely on who may give them the best tax policy or the best government benefit? It supposes a materialism that is not, I think, what we find in our daily life when we interact with people. When the top of mind issues are, unless except for in dire economic times, are often from the panoply of social issues. And the simple answer to your question is obviously that social issues came to the fore of the American politics, especially by the late 60s, and beginning with civil rights and the racialized politics that went with it, then the Vietnam War, and divides as basic as how you see the flag and whether you see it as a symbol that can be, that captures America's best or America's worst. And, you know, the law and order issue, and of course, all of this, we can then take forward to the 80s and 90s and the modern day. But white working class, blue collar white, middle class, blue collar white, not necessarily a graduate or 4-year degree. We overestimate how much, and I think the era of Trump has reminded people of this, we overestimate how much of voting is below the neck. And that when people feel that they are forgotten, that their leaders don't care about them, once they get into office, as the white working class felt at the highest levels of all groups as Trump came into the campaign in 2015, when people feel that government might not necessarily be an obstacle to their lives, but it does little for them, and that people in power don't care about them, and that they see a Republican Party that, in their view, only cares about the wealthy, and they see a Democratic Party that seems to care about everybody but them, and in fact, the liberalism, in their view, or liberal elites who often invalidate their very sense of alienation, because though they may be struggling check to check, they are white, and so they are told they are privileged, so even their alienation is invalidated, or their feelings of alienation, which of course how could you infuriate anybody more than that, than to say that you are that even the reason you're angry is not silly.
Yeah, valid. When we go back to this era that you so brilliantly capture for us, Richard Scammon, Ben Wattenberg, the real majority, you had Richard Nixon at the time saying, on tough problems, the uneducated are the ones that are with us. And so he was already figuring out the psyche here and how those cultural markers were so important to defining the new majority, if you will, that he was hoping to build for the Republican Party. Very briefly, Ronald Reagan in that foment and how he cemented a lot of this. And are we living more under what happened with Richard Nixon, or is it really Ronald Reagan's revolution? And tell us how Donald Trump co-opted it and took the mantle, if you will, because I don't know where George W. Bush actually fits into all of this, but help us to understand the political impacts of Reagan and Trump in all of this.
Ronald Reagan finished what Nixon began. Nixon lays out the strategic framework, the modern strategic framework of all successful Republican presidents thereafter, by effectively writing a playbook that can break apart and lead to the fraction of the Republican coalition. And that is largely and if it's put in the most simplistic terms, framing campaigns for many decades after as mainstream versus extreme, if you had to pick at that dynamic. Reagan basically coalesces Goldwater right with the bygone FDR Democrats of old and traditional Republican voters. He does it with all that we now consider Reagan-esque. I would say what the great gap between that coalition and what Trump did is that if you look at the America of the 80s versus the America of 2010s, in the shadow of the Great Recession. So there was a terrible recession in the 80s, and the industrialization of America was beginning to had hit America terribly hard for a decade. But it had not changed America in the sense that there was still in the 80s, the white working class would effectively lose. They were about half of the wealth in the 70s in the United States. And by around the Trump era, they were only about 25% of the nation's wealth, even though their population had, as a share of the population, had not decreased at nearly that same rate. And what is going on? Obviously, it's the deindustrialization of America that happens over the next 30 years. It's the loss of good union paying jobs. It's the downward wage pressure. One can go on and on and on. But what happens is that the Republican Party over the next few decades, while they're winning these voters, often in its most simplistic say, we can say the social issue, or in some sense, because there's a sense that the Democratic Party doesn't even care to win them back. The Republican Party stops noticing that while they're championing hypercapitalism, the victims of hypercapitalism are gradually becoming the majority of their voters. And that's where Trump came in. In other words, Ross Perot in the 90s was a shot across the bow of what was possible. If you look at Perot's voters, they were more blue collar than not, more male than not. And Perot brought to fore, if we recall, the factory jobs at that time going to Mexico, right? When it was not at the core of either major party's conversation. And so I think what you have with Trump, much of the echoes of what Nixon and Reagan formulated, but you have the added factor of the post-Great Recession America and decades and decades of its deindustrialization and the loss of good blue-collar work, and Trump becoming a vehicle for that discontent.
However, and up until the point of the pandemic, there are those who thought that as much as many Americans, including those in the group that we're talking about, who were turned off by him personally, but they would still look at him and say, well, the economy is doing all right, and maybe he could have squeaked by again in 2020. How much have we scrambled our politics today with pandemic response? As I speak with you today, there's rioting anew in America. As you look at it, how scrambled is the picture that we're now seeing going forward?
Without a doubt, Donald Trump, you can just objectively state a few things. As terrible as a pandemic or a war is, it can be, or a great economic crisis, it can be good for a leader of a nation state because the people have a tendency to rally around their flag. And they have a tenant and they want to believe in their leader. So Trump did not achieve the support balance that other leaders in other countries did once the coronavirus pandemic began to seriously afflict the United States. And that has meant that he is in, objectively a dire economic straits. And I don't mean that just because of its impact on the economy. But we would also be foolish to say that he has lost his race. I would say that Donald Trump is just in an extremely weak position based on all historical standards of how what it's to win the presidency. And I know it's tempting to always do the but they didn't. But the experts got Donald Trump wrong the first time. Yes and no. I didn't really get Donald Trump wrong the first time. I thought he would be a nightmare for Hillary Clinton. And while Donald Trump still has his base and our best media and our best minds often misunderstand that base by assuming that just because they support Donald Trump as a candidate, they support Donald Trump on everything. He is in an extremely weak position, and you can sort of see why the Biden campaign at this point is trying as much as they can to have it just be a referendum on the incumbent president.
Let me ask you, as we look going forward, there was one candidate, Congressman Ryan, I believe his name was, from Wisconsin, who was in the primary for the Democrats for some time, and he was talking himself about the hard hats, if you will. He was talking about the guys and the women who take a shower after work, not before work. That's the way he put it.
Has anyone really picked up that mantle with a positive message about what may be the forward opportunities here in America with better vocational training, with people who are converting to the gig economy, but perhaps in new ways, or taking their old skills and helping to rebuild America with infrastructure? I know that that conversation is starting again, at least at the beginning stages. But is there anybody who's really captured the imagination or energy, or do you see that belonging to either party at this point?
No one has captured it at a national level. I think you name someone who has locally spoken to it, and there are plenty of politicians that do. No one has captured it. It's a nebulous energy that's everywhere in American life, and floats between the two parties. And until a candidate realizes that, in many cases, for example, working class blacks and working class whites and Hispanics have much more in common than they do apart, that, you know, that opportunity may not be fully realized. But both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party have, they have to face that dynamic differently. They both have different electoral burdens and stereotypes to deal with, you know, in their efforts to sort of court this constituency. For example, much of the anti-Trump right, these quote-unquote Lincoln Republicans, they didn't have any problem for decade after decade, you know, largely ignoring their blue-collar base. So they may have, and I think they do have, principled reasons to be frustrated with the leader of their current party and to, in some sense, to despise it on some cases. You know, it was those same political strategists and politicians who, you know, didn't seem to make a stink when the China entered the WTO, or when factory jobs were leaving cities and Main Street shops were shuttering, and into the Great Recession. I mean, I was writing about this constantly, but, you know, as I pointed out at the time, Washington, D.C., and by that I mean political D.C., not, I don't mean the very poor sections of D.C., I mean where the politicians, media, strategists live, and the lobbyists, and the entire what I call the political class, they never had a recession. Across the Great Recession, they never had a recession. If you actually look at the economic data, the disconnect between those who govern and the governed is grotesque and immense, and it began a half century ago in this era that I write about, and I think it frames modern American politics, and the politician and maybe some public figure who can unite that energy and perhaps prove larger than either party and not entirely of either party, and yet bring out people's perhaps their best and not necessarily their worst, has a great political future. But we'll see. We've been looking for that politician for a very long time.
Well, one political scientist called your book the most persuasive explanation for the rise of Donald Trump that has yet appeared. So glowing remarks about this book, and I hope you captured some of that essence in the conversation today. I really encourage you to get the book. David Paul Kuhn's The Hard Hat Riot. And if you want to go back to those turbulent days, and I lived them, I was old enough at that time, and it was a remarkable period in American history. And yet this particular event, I think, has been forgotten, but you have brought it back to the fore at a very, very crucial time. And I thank you so much, David, for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers 40 years of experience in industries from manufacturing to professional services to nonprofits.